often based on occupation or profession and practiced within endogamous social systems, which is to say where communities marry within the communities. So all those different elements are important to make a system caste, that you are born into a caste and you cannot leave that caste. And your social relationships, including marital relationships, are within that particular caste. It defines you. That caste location is not innocent. It is extremely horrific. The reason for the existence of the caste system is to sort of create those social exclusions and inclusions. And so there is very much a kind of a definition of your social identity through caste. So that's a second important part of it. The third important part of it, which I think is not always true in practice, though in imagination it seems to be there, is that every caste is linked to a particular profession or a particular occupation. So I think there's a twofold element here. One is that, of course, that kind of social exclusion, which happens when you identify a community with something which is seen as polluting. And in fact, those kinds of jobs might be reserved for people from that community. There's also an economic work that the caste system does by making large numbers of the society weak in terms of their ability to exert their rights when it comes to labor and work. And so you make them available as a kind of economic agricultural labor force. Does America have a caste system? Is an article which is more journalistic in nature that I wrote as I was doing the sort of writing and the research that I've described before, both for my novel and other things that I've written in a more scholarly vein. I had an invitation to be a visiting scholar in residence for a week at the University of Houston downtown. And I had been invited there precisely because of my work around caste and things which I've written about race. So I did some different presentations, met with a lot of students. The University of Houston downtown is overwhelmingly minority, Latino and also Black. And it's a satellite campus of the University of Houston main campus. So very sort of working class, very minority. And so in the conversations, very informal conversations that I was having with them, and after a few presentations that I made about caste, both to faculty as well as to students, kind of explaining what it was and talking about it, a few students said, well, you know, that's not very similar to my experience. What you're describing, you know, in terms of generations of my family, in terms of expectations of what jobs are available to us, in terms of finding it very difficult to make certain moves to change our realities, this seems very familiar to me. And so there is a tradition within American intellectual thought to use caste to think about what we would now look at through the category of race. It's as recently as the early 60s, anthropologist Gerald Berryman, who in fact, if I remember correctly, taught at Berkeley for most of his career, and who was an anthropologist of India and had written a book on the caste system in North Indian villages, returned from India after research in the midst of the civil rights movement and wrote this short article, which is actually quite well known, in which he essentially made the argument that the Jim Crow South was a caste society. Because he said, here's what I see in this village in North India, and here's what is going on in this Jim Crow towns pre-civil rights, or just at the cusp of the civil rights change. This is what different water fountains for Black people and white people. Untouchability, pollution codes, right? So those kinds of... So he made a pretty compelling argument about Jim Crow South being a caste society, which could be compared to the caste system that he had been studying in North India. And I think it would not be an extreme statement to make, to my mind at all, to bring out the completely horrific nature of caste system, to compare it to apartheid or to segregation, because it is certainly the case that cities in India are, till today, segregated in many ways, right, on caste terms, which are not immediately evident to a visitor and may not even be immediately evident to residents, but because there is a class element to caste as well, that certain parts of the city which are poorer and have less access to resources would tend to be lower caste, and will have different temples there, will have different icons, will have different kinds of restaurants, because, you know, vegetarianism, which is very closely linked with India, is very much an upper caste phenomenon. The upper caste Brahmins and other upper castes tend to be vegetarian, and tend is the right word, and the lower castes tend to be non-vegetarian. And so the cuisine, the foods, the what is sold in the grocery stores, all of that would be very much segregated.
We had wanted to talk about Ambedkar. Mm-hmm. Dr. Ambedkar was a pivotal, a very important person in Indian history in a number of ways.
Oh, I think he's absolutely one of the towering figures of Indian intellectual thought, and I would say of global thought. Ambedkar was Dalit, which is the preferred term that the most politicized elements of the so-called untouchable communities use. And against great odds, he educated himself both in the UK and in the US. He attended Columbia University and received advanced degrees from Columbia and from the London School of Economics, and then returned to India and was very active there for many decades, the same time that Gandhi was. So this is pre-independence, although he lived on to post-independence. His writings were all very much aimed at bringing a critical eye to the caste system and to provide the intellectual arsenal. He was a politician and very much involved in movements and mobilizations, but he was also a kind of an intellectual figure trying to create the intellectual arsenal by which caste could be undone. He's often referred to as the father of the Indian Constitution because he was the chair of the Constitutional Committee, which wrote the Constitution of India. You can go into certain neighborhoods and there will be a statue of Ambedkar with a book under his arm, which is the Constitution of India, with glasses on and looking extremely serious. And that is both true and something that we have to be careful about, because it is true the role he played before independence and the role he played after independence in designing what has been described by some legal scholars as one of the most liberal constitutions in the world. I want to be very careful. That doesn't make India liberal. It's a constitution is liberal, right? I mean, the constitution has many fine elements to it. So his role in that is not to be minimized. But there was also a tokenization of it, right? So just father of the constitution, we'll put a statue of him in this part of the city, but we'll forget everything else. We'll forget all the other, really, the way in which he really criticized Gandhi for his inattention to the atrocious nature of caste, and some of his more radical sort of criticisms of Indian society. He converted to Buddhism a few months before he died. And the conversion itself was a long journey for him. You know, it took him, you know, many years and many decades of working his way through to it. And there are different ways of understanding why and how he converted, which again would, you know, take us very far afield. So I'll go to the nub of your question, which is, can you escape the caste system by converting? That's the main question I think you're asking. And it goes back to the notion of the wall, or let's put it, can you scale the wall? Can you scale the wall by converting? And here again, the answer is somewhat mixed. You know, and his conversion to Buddhism is because of the role of Buddhism, both in Indian history and the philosophical foundations of Buddhism. As people might know, the emergence of Buddhism 2,500 years ago was partly in response to the hegemony of Brahmins. I say partly, and I don't want to imply that the caste system as it exists now was exactly what the caste system was then, but let's just say that there were hierarchical structures, and certainly Brahmins, who are ritualists with religious functions, had achieved a certain kind of hegemony in that ancient Indian society. And the Buddha, who was from a high caste, if you can say that, he was a prince, but he was not a Brahmin, but he was a prince, actually led a kind of social movement, if you like, which challenged Brahmin hegemony. But in doing that, it also very much created the philosophical basis to challenge caste as a whole. Buddhism, I think, is attractive to Ambedkar because of that. I think the right way to put it is that caste can follow you. You know, even if you convert, are you a Brahmin convert? Are you a Dalit convert? Are you like somebody from one of the middle castes? And do you continue to be stigmatized that way? And I think it is, to my mind, quite incontestable that many of these caste practices have followed here. Despite what many Indian Americans will say, even when they consider themselves liberal. So the liberal manifestation of this will be like, of course, I'm against caste, and that belongs to the old country. It belongs to the country that I left. It belongs to the country that my parents left. I don't really subscribe to it, and why are we still talking about it? We don't need to talk about it. We are now in a new country. It's like this. Without reflecting on who their social networks are, what kind of privileges have, like, I'm assuming that this person is an upper caste person, right? So without really, or like their unspoken, unconscious practices, which continue to benefit from caste systems and also contribute to acknowledging the existence of caste is the first step. It is also acknowledging ways in which your privilege needs to take a backseat at various times in order to create space, because these things don't happen just by the articulation of utopian ideas, but by the creation of actual spaces into which excluded voices can come. To both recognize the absolutely horrific and atrocious nature of the caste system and all the ways in which it puts in place exclusions and makes it difficult for people to speak, for people to find the right ways to assert themselves, to acknowledge that, but also to acknowledge that despite the odds, people have spoken, people have acted, and change has happened. A few decades ago, if somebody from a lower caste were walking through or walking in the vicinity, in some cases, of course, you wouldn't even be allowed to walk through an upper caste part of the village. You know, things had changed enough that you could walk through, or you were in the vicinity of a upper caste part of a village, you had to take your shoes off because you had to walk barefoot. So these are practices which persist. I think the more invidious forms of this kind of exclusion is important, right? These are social networks of exclusion. You have an advantage because you know somebody who is hiring in this office, and that's available to you because you have upper caste networks. And if you're lower caste, you don't have that. But I think it is worth asking whether a kind of a deep study of caste allows us to understand hierarchical systems everywhere. So scholars have noted that the Burakumin in Japan are a caste society, and that there are caste societies in West Africa and in certain parts of Europe, and so on. And even beyond that, just the study of caste itself, whether it's useful, as Gerald Berman said, whether the Jim Crow South is really a caste society, to how far can you take that understanding of caste that you find in Ambedkar and in other anti-caste radical thinkers and use it to understand societies which are their own forms of hierarchization.
I'm Amrita, and I'm a medical student here in studying in India. I'm Dalit, I'm non-binary, and I'm asexual. And so I also want to work on more political issues rather than just focusing on political science. So that's how my journey about writing things started.
So this sounds like this is what motivated you to get to write the article for Gazy.
Well, like, I follow their Instagram page. So, like, they had put this pitch that they are looking for Dalit queer people to write about the experiences of Pride Month. So I saw that and I just, like, sent an email. I've gotten quite a lot of positive reactions. A lot of people said that they felt heard by what I said. And a lot of other Dalit queer people I've met online, they've said that they have experienced similar things. Your community or your Dalit community might accept you because of the caste discrimination you face from others, but they will still reject the queer part of you, whereas queer spaces are still dominated largely by upper caste people. So there, it's like, if you talk about caste, then they get touchy and defensive, and they'll be like, no, no, we don't see caste. We don't see caste. We have Dalit friends. We have Adivasi friends. So there it becomes like, you should not bring up caste, because then, you know, it makes the whole thing awkward, and you feel like you had this space of belonging, but now you've kind of made it weird as well. Even now, even on campus and elsewhere, I'm much more openly and easily saying that I'm queer rather than saying that I'm Dalit, because the fear and the repercussions of revealing my caste identity openly is something which we are taught since a young age, that you do not say it, because once they get to know that, they will start very subtly discriminating against you. And I can say I'm queer, that's fine. Means obviously that also has a lot of homophobic reactions, but to reveal that I'm Dalit is something which is I'll do at a much later stage of getting to know a person. For most people, they kind of assume that queerness is something you kind of realize in later stage of your life. Like if you're born in the particular kind of skin color, you're born into a particular religion, into a particular caste. You do not have a control over it. From the moment I was born, I was already given these two things to wrestle with while going into the outside world. And then, like I choose to also reveal myself as like this, adding another category, a marginalized identity to my own self. That's why I say that I have been born with enough oppression on my plate, because being born as a woman, or like being born as female and being born as a Dalit, is something which I cannot change.
And your parents sounded like they had a particular response in the beginning, and we were wondering if you could talk about that and whether that has changed over time at all.
My dad, definitely, I have not spoken to him about this, basically almost none. But my mom, she's more understanding, so I do, but I kind of keep it less because she still feels these are weird. I think, she just is kind of more sympathetic that, okay, at least listen to my children and see what they have to say. Now, currently with, like, me identifying with the labels as asexual and non-binary. So asexuality, according to Indian culture, feels something, they think it's like celibacy, but it's not. But that's more palatable to them than me going around, whatever, getting into a relationship with another girl or someone who's not a boy. So my mom is still kind of fine with it. She's like, okay, maybe eventually you want to have kids. I'm like, no, I'm just telling you right now so that you don't dream of my marriage. I'm telling you to stop from that disappointment. About my non-binary identity, like, they have kind of entertained it, I guess, to a limit, like me suddenly getting short hair and having, like, adding more masculine looking clothes to my wardrobe, and also, like hitting the gym and all of that. But they still have their own qualms about it. And my mom, like, she has expressed her discomfort quite clearly, and she kind of projects it as she's scared about what the society will think of me, which is valid, because, like, sexuality is still something you can kind of hide. Like, like that trope goes that bisexual and asexual people aren't that oppressed. But if you're having short hair and if you look gender ambiguous, then it instantly caught notice by anyone on the road, and you might get attacked or whatever. She says, professors at college might discriminate against you. They haven't until now, but these things you're never really too sure.
But it sounds like you've had some inspiration as well, and that comes from Dr. Ambedkar and Savitribai Phule. So
Yes,
maybe you
Savitri
thank you.
Phule.
Maybe you could talk about what they've meant to you as a queer Dalit person.
Ambedkar, it's common knowledge that he supported women's rights, he supported queer people's rights even back then, even back when our Indian constitution was being made, like in 1948. So he was quite progressive on all those fronts, and he's responsible for a lot of rights that Hindu women have gotten over the years, like the right to property, the right to education. So, and apart from that is the reservations aspect, like what is called affirmative action in the US. So he stands the inspiration because he, even being a Dalit person, he studied and he faced all the caste discriminations and he fought through it, and then, he decided to do something for the future generations. And Savitribai Phule, she was active around 1850s. So She was actually a Brahmin. So she was upper caste. She was married to this upper caste man. But the man, Jyotibai Phule, he decided that he wanted to educate his wife. And then both of them together went on to establish three schools, and specifically for teaching girls. That is, it's like around 100 years before Ambedkar, around 100 years before the constitution. So it was a huge scandal itself that a Brahmin man is educating his wife, and then now they're sitting and making schools where girls of all castes can sit together and study. And there was a lot of social ostracization that they both had to face. They were kicked out of their houses. People used to throw mud at them and call them slurs. But they still continue to do it. So it's the same thing there that, you have to do some things which are hard and which will be having reactions from the people, but you do it for the future generations. You do it not seeing just for your own comforts, but for the future. Growing up, I did learn these things, about the caste, about patriarchy, about discrimination, but you aren't really made aware of those things to that degree if you're just studying in school. I remember when I was a kid and, reading the newspaper and, seeing all this stuff, like, there's some war going on and this and that, but they were, like, always short articles which had no context. So you don't really see the context. It's a similar thing for the Palestine issue. So, but now I've grown up, and now since I'm digging deeper into this thing, so I go deeper into that issue and I trace how this thing has been going on for almost 75 years now, how it's a long story and how so many other factors are connected to it. And again, I see that along my learning journey, as I realize that what colonialism is, what the US has been doing, this occupation of land and resources, and how that's the root cause of most of the wars. But honestly, like, if I say that I'm already kind of struggling medical school, if bombs are dropping here, I would lose my wish. And they have to live through it, and why do they have to? Why are we making their lives worse? And why is the system in place which deems that some people are worth saving and sucking up all the resources for their own comfort, while other people have to be deprived and die? How colonialism is affected to queerness. Along with that, there's the transgender and what we call here kinners. They're like a subset, you could call them part of the gender spectrum, but they were an important part of the Indian community. They used to be called to celebrate marriages and births. They were seen as good omens. And then the British came and they put them in these criminal tribes along with a lot of other nomadic tribes in India. And ever since then, they have been pushed to the fringes of the economic system, and they have now struggled and do sex work and be harassed everywhere. Recently, there was this ruling by the Supreme Court that they deemed that certain parts of the scheduled castes, like scheduled castes, scheduled tribes, are like the administrative label for Dalits and Adivasis. So they said that people in the SCSTs who have gotten above a certain salary per year, they are supposed to be called creamy layer, and they will not be away the reservations anymore. So that has caused quite an uproar in the community here for obvious reasons, because this is seen more as an attempt to divide the Dalit and Adivasi community from the solidarity rather than do something truly for the benefit. Because even after the constitution, even after Ambedkar, and even after reservations for the last 75 years, there are still very subtle ways of excluding SCST people from jobs, at the level of jobs, I would say. So, you might see that a lot of PhD and learned people with graduates who are from these communities, but they are not getting jobs because they are being discriminated like this. And how are they supposed to control that? I remember, I wrote in one of my posts for my page that the first time I joined the college, and everyone was just asking me, what is your rank? So what they mean is, what is your caste? Because they want to see if your rank is lower than the cutoff. That means that you've gotten a reservation that you've come here. And you know, like, it starts at the very edge. And for people here, they just feel that, you know, caste is just affirmative actions and it's just like an easy ticket. But that's not what it is, because it's so many more things. It's, you know, getting called slurs when you're a kid, having a different social group, and them not wanting to sit with you. They'll be like scowling at your lunch because you've brought egg, and they'll be like saying it stinks. Now, you know, like, Indian society has progressed a bit, so it's much more liberal. So you might, here on campus, I'll be seeing so many couples, like cis-het couples, most of them, and they're like inter-caste maybe, but you know, like, you won't see them getting married, even if they're such great people, such great bonds, because at the end of the day, it will be the families who will be coming in, and they will be saying that, no, you cannot marry them because they're out of your caste. Just because you go to eat with your Dalit friend at a restaurant does not mean that you have completely eradicated it. I would point out that the people who first immigrated to US and UK, most of the rich people in India are upper caste, and the rich people have the money and the resources to go study and settle abroad. So they're taking their casteism with them there. And there itself, there's a lobby that if you enter USA and if you're not one of the upper castes, then you're left even lesser network. And when you're in a foreign country, you suppose that your countrymen will help you out. But there also, you know, like, it doesn't matter that you're an Indian. It matters more that you're not from their caste, because at the end of the day, this Hindu religion extremism is a very caste-based at its core. It's not just sufficient to kind of grow up learning that you must be wary of casteism, you must be wary of sexism, and to believe in those things. But you know, that's on a very individual level. To really understand how these things came about, you have to study the history, you have to see how these larger structures are at play. And that is something which is not taught in schools. And that is also for a reason, because they do not want us to know. So you have to go beyond your school, college curriculum, you have to go beyond what the education system deems as important, scoring good grades. You have to go beyond that if you have to learn about those things. And these things, it takes up time, it takes up energy to learn about these things, but that's the kind of sacrifice you have to make, otherwise you're just stuck in the same place. My priorities have now changed, because like growing up, I was mostly a typical kid, and you know, like, with the aspirations that I'll get a good job and make my parents proud. And I think even before that, like, I had the goal that I would be a doctor to give service to people. But you know, that's not as decisive as saying that, you know, I will actually work for the liberation, because working in a government hospital, you know, like, we see a lot of patients here. They're coming from the poorest of backgrounds, from far-flung villages with such severe diseases, because they do not have access to healthcare there, and so they just keep postponing coming to the doctor, and now they come and they're suffering a lot. You can say that, you know, we are government doctors, we are doing it for cheap, but then you have to ask that, why are they poor, and why are there not enough big hospitals to treat these people? It's the same thing with charity or donations, that why does the system of altruism or these NGOs, why is it that people are poor? Because you always have to keep giving them this small benefit, so why not make it just so that people are not poor? And in that, what I said is, like, you know, educate, agitate, and organize. So that's the blueprint of how things happen. That's how revolutions have happened.
They ain't no different from me, not above, not beneath. Teach them equality.
Thank you for listening to part 7 of Good Fences Make Good Neighbors, or Do They? A focus on caste. Sheetal Mehta read Rohith Vemula's suicide letter. Music by Sarah Hopkins, Moby, Don Cherry and Ed Blackwell, and Aradhana. We want to thank Amrita, Yashika Dutt, and Subramanian Shankar for their participation in this program. This show was produced by Mary Salomi and Emily Charles, a Queer in Your Ear production.